Now, if you've been here the last time we were in this text, we know in chapter 7 we really got to see Gideon interact with some really miraculous stuff. God had really moved on behalf of Gideon. And that was that whole story about how he started out with a whole lot of guys, and then in the end he had 300 guys left, and he still defeated the enemies because God wanted to show him that man's ability, man's power, that his success is not contingent on man's ability and man's what man's got. Even in that respect, we would do well to learn a lesson from that. God's not limited, gang. Maybe sometimes we just need to be reminded over and over, He's God. He's God. He can do anything. He does do anything. In this story, what happened is after the initial triumph there in that valley, when the 300 men of Gideon had miraculously moved against thousands of troops of the Midianites, that the people of Ephraim now were kind of ticked off that they weren't included in all of that. Now, one might see easily when you read this account that maybe the tribe of Ephraim, they feel like that they may have had a legitimate complaint in all of this. I mean, they felt like they had been left out of what was going on. I mean, after all, Gideon was from the tribe of Ephraim. He was an Ephraimite. So, you know, one would naturally have thought that he would have called up those guys if he was going to go to war. And yet, the opinion and the observation of this would certainly be flawed. If we just step back from this for a minute, why I read it in the Living Bible, we need to kind of step back from this for a minute and really look at this from a distance and ask some questions here. One, if this was the case, how would Gideon have gone to war against the people of Midian without any of the tribe of Ephraim hearing about this? I mean, I realize this was before the age of the telephone and computer and emails and all the rest, but understand this, that Gideon had raised up an army out of all of Israel. Okay, so word had spread. You want to go and you want to fight with Gideon. You want to raise the sword against the Midianites. If you believe in this, Gideon's going to go and he's going to take on the Midianites. So all of Israel would have known this was going to go on. So the fact is, he couldn't have gone to war without the tribe of Ephraim knowing about it. Because again, Gideon had raised an army out of all of Israel. He couldn't have done that quietly. So they would have known he was doing this. Now, no doubt the truth was that his brethren essentially had ignored him when that was going on. And perhaps thought him, frankly, foolish for even taking on that endeavor. If you've been here as we've been going through this, you know that the Midianites had repeatedly, year after year, laid siege upon Israel, taken what they wanted, and they just kept whooping them and whooping them and whooping them over and over again. So that was number one. Secondly, it wasn't like the Midianites laying siege on Israel was a mystery to Ephraim or any of the tribes for that matter. They had done it year after year after year. They had beat up on Israel over and over again. And we have absolutely no record here of Ephraim as a tribe. And please remember, Ephraim was the biggest tribe in all of Israel. That they had ever attempted to deal with the Midianites on their own. They hadn't done anything. I mean, they just sat back and took it. They were being passive. They weren't being brave enough to step up. But Gideon had. And now that Gideon did and was successful, now all of a sudden, the feelings of the tribe of Ephraim was all of a sudden, it was hurt. No doubt the truth of this matter was that their brethren there of Ephraim had essentially just ignored him. They had not attempted to do this. Thirdly, God wanted a small army. If you were here the last time we were in Judges, you know that. You know that God had started out with a big number of guys, and in the end there was only 300. So God wanted a small army, and he did that on purpose so that he would be glorified and not Israel. So it didn't really matter. God only wanted a few boys so that God could be glorified. Now, no doubt pride here was already an issue. That was already in play here. So God had purposely chosen 300 guys, and it seems to, for at least a secondary reason, he didn't want to throw gas on the fire. These guys, even though they were being beaten up, taken advantage of, Ephraim I'm talking about, year after year after year, they still were arrogant. They still were prideful. Now, I don't know if you've ever seen a situation like that, where somebody is like, you have absolutely nothing to be proud of, and they just wear it like a hat. I mean, you know, did you ever have a situation where you wanted to tell somebody, look, dude, you're not smart, you're not rich, you're not handsome, you got nothing. What have you got to be arrogant about? And yet their pride kind of just runs without any explanation. You know, the thing about pride is behind every single sin we ever commit. If we could manage to overcome the issue of human pride, we wouldn't have the problems of sin. We wouldn't have the problems of rebellion against God. It all comes down to pride. Pride's behind it all. So there was indeed no record here of an overt and concrete request from Ephraim in the beginning. Okay, there wasn't anything like, gee, we wanted to come and you turned us down. And there wasn't any record of Gideon asking them. So, I mean, this was true. He didn't ask them. I mean, we don't have any records of any phone calls, no faxes, no emails. Nothing like that went down. Though certainly, when you see how Ephraim acted to this, can you maybe relate a little bit? Can you kind of figure, hey, maybe that was Gideon's beef from the beginning? I mean, these guys are so arrogant and so pushy. Maybe I just don't even want them to be along. I mean, it causes pause here that maybe their attitudes and their reactions would have ended up only being a detriment to what Gideon was trying to do, so he purposely didn't make an invite. Again, I am sure we all can imagine scenarios in our world where certain people, if they were invited, they may be extra hands, they may be more muscle to that scene, but they would also be more problematic and more distracting to what was trying to go on, that, you know, it's better to just not offer, okay? Be bringing more grief than it's worth it. Do we know that that's a fact? No, we don't. But certainly we see how he reacted, and we all can kind of take a step back and we can see that perhaps that Ephraim's reaction to Gideon and all of this would have made him take pause from the beginning. Now, what it looks like to me, for whatever that's worth, it looks to me like what we have here is quite simply a flagrant issue of just petty jealousy and pride. I mean, Gideon had been up front and center now to a great work of God. Even if the Ephraimites didn't understand or recognize the God part, they did recognize the fact that all of a sudden Gideon, he was the man. Okay, he was the man of the hour. So pride, what happens naturally in all of us, pride wants to kind of saddle up to that kind of thing, right? And the sad thing about pride is inevitably, and it's a weird scenario, but inevitably anger seems to accompany jealousy. Jealousy is not a peaceful human reaction. Jealousy is the cause of all sorts of crimes and sins and terrible things in the world that we live in. So there was no sign of thankfulness here from Ephraim, the tribe of Ephraim, to Gideon or for Gideon or even to God for what God had done at the hand of Gideon. Despite the fact that Gideon's victory was going to play in their world. I mean, there was going to be a great benefit for all the tribes of Israel, including Ephraim, because of what Gideon did. I mean, the phone call didn't come down the pike. Oh, hey, Gideon, dude, man, thanks for what you did. That was awesome. Oh, man, thanks, man. You really blessed us. Now we're free. It wasn't like that at all. It was like, hey, man, how come you didn't call? And the only way we can read that is Ephraim, the tribe of Ephraim, was upset because they didn't get to have a piece of the glory. That isn't a hard scenario to imagine in the world that we live in. The heart of man really hasn't changed much in all these thousands of years. We still have the same problems, the same downfalls. And when the Bible says the heart of man is desperately wicked, it played then, it plays now. There was no sign of thankfulness. Instead, they were bitter. And from our point of view, from standing back here in 2014, we look at that and it's like, oh, come on, man. What have you got to be bitter about? And yet bitterness defies all logic. You can't reason the issue of bitterness. They were bitter that God had used Gideon instead of them. They were bitter because Gideon was the man and they weren't. They were bitter because Gideon was getting glory and attention, and they weren't. Now, I got to believe as we approach that simplistic scenario that there isn't a person that's here tonight that can't understand that and can't relate to that. And even if we looked into our own lives, without looking around at everyone else, just looking at our own lives, we all know that we have that potential to be just like that. One of the benefits of growing older, there's not a lot, but there's a couple. One of them is that you'll be able to step back and you realize that Jesus Christ came to save us, not because we just want salvation, but gang, we need it. We need it. And I don't know about you guys, and I don't know if I was just out of like reality too long over in the Philippines. I came back, I started reading newspaper, and it just seems like all hell's breaking loose out here. The whole world is just in turmoil. I mean, people dying of Ebola? Ebola! I mean, that's the stuff of horror flicks, isn't it? And I don't know what's going to play out there in the Middle East. There seems to be no end to that. And the entire continent of Africa seems to be in turmoil. I can't even keep it straight of who's killing who and where they're running. And they can't run anywhere because that country's in turmoil. It's a dangerous world out there. It's a sad reality, I think, that oftentimes, even in great victory, instead of receiving blessing, instead of receiving support from those that we count as brethren and count as family, let's face it, oftentimes instead we only get grief. I wish it wasn't so. I wish we could even say us here, oh yeah, oh, other churches are that way, but not Jesus Fellowship. No. We would never be like that to each other. Yeah, and if you're new around here or you're a guest here, well, just, you know, buckle up because you're going to find we're just like everyone else. This is a church full of sinners, right on up here to this seat right here. Gideon, he could have just been furious here and he could have struck back. I mean, he kind of had the big God mo going there. Maybe he's just like, hey, man, I only got 300 guys, but I'll whoop all of you guys just like I did the Midianites. But he didn't do that, did he? I mean, I can put myself in his shoes, and I don't think I would have took that quite so easy. He could have struck back because you know what? Those guys that are there in Ephraim, it's always easy to be an armchair quarterback, isn't it? The world's full of them. Spectator supervisors. Betty wants to tell you how to do the job. And we all want to be a part of the winning team. I mean, so oftentimes we want to be a part of the winning team so badly that many of us will actually wait till a team wins and then we'll throw our support that way. Yeah, as always, for the Packers. You know, and then, whoa, they lose. It's like, nah, I'm a Vikings fan. You know, it's just our tendency, right? I mean, nobody's like rooting for some, you know, B team that gets wiped out, you know, and they have a losing season. I mean, we want to root for the winners. Why? Because somehow we think since we root for the winners, that makes us a winner. Hey, guys, I don't know how to tell you this, but just because you're rooting for the winners doesn't make you a winner. But that's the human tendency, isn't it? We all want to be a part of the winning team. That's the story of Judges chapter 8. And it happened on more than one occasion. You know, I think it's worth mentioning here, and it's something that we as Christians need to get it through our brains. Satan loves it when Christians fight. I mean, can you imagine? I don't know. I can put myself in that shoes. I mean, I can see it. He absolutely loves it when Christians fight. See, the idea is, well, look, if I can't make any headway against the church from the outside, well, he's just going to then, therefore, turn his attention, quite successfully, I might add, to the inside. When I say quite successfully, it seems in the past 50 years, that's been the new direction, and he's done quite a job on it. So it's like a cancer, you see. It just kind of consumes the churches and the fellowships and the families and the friendships all from the inside. And if you think, though, that that is a recent phenomenon, you need to read the book of Acts. The whole Ananias and Sapphira and on and on and on. And then you can read Paul's letters. He always gets to the end and there's always like, you know, Bob and Jane, you know, they're being bad and tell them to knock it off and that kind of stuff. So we find out that this is not a new phenomenon. Even in the early church, there were incidents. Incidents that would be, I think, familiar to our century easily. And Satan loves it. The reason why he loves it is because if we're not busy, if we are busy fighting ourselves, then we're not pursuing the enemy. That doesn't take great strategy, right? If we're fighting amongst ourselves, we're not fighting the enemy. And it is astonishing because so oftentimes and please don't misunderstand me. My eyes are on this church first, but certainly I look at the greater church around and it seems like that there are churches that have lost their entire focus. They've decided that this thing or that thing is the enemy or that person in that church is the enemy, and they've lost their entire focus as far as who the battle is to be waged against. I mean, we've all probably all seen that church down in Kansas that, you know, it's just like a family and a half, and they just travel around the nation with posters and placards and telling people that God hates gays and he's going to, you know, burn them all in hell. Just so we all understand, God does not hate gays. Does he hate the sin? Sure. He hates your sin too, by the way, and my sin. But he loves gays. He loves everybody. He died on the cross for everybody. So let's remember that. But we lose our focus. So now the devil isn't the problem. Homosexuality is the problem. No, that's a symptom. And it's amazing over the years what I've taken on the chin. Yeah, JFB, you're terrible over there because you're not using King James only Bibles. You're kidding, right? Seriously, that's your battle? Because we're not using King James? Which King James Bible, by the way? They go, what do you mean? There was 5 original versions of the old King James Bible. Which one are you using? That'll spin their head around. See, I know a little too much about it. And whatever battles we got. Oh, you know, it's this, it's that. You said this, you believe that, and we all want to fight. Now, I'm not saying there's not ground worth fighting. We're going to get into that in just a second. Because I don't believe in crying peace, peace when there is no peace. But how oftentimes we're fighting over stupid stuff when we need to be fighting after Satan. In the meantime, Satan just continues to gain ground in this country and in every country. And I think he's snickering all the way. James 3:16 states boldly, where envy and self-seeking exists, confusion and every evil thing are there. Again, where there's envy and self-seeking, there is confusion and every evil thing. Amen. Envy and self-seeking, what do you get? Confusion. Chaos. See, Satan can get us so wrapped up in ourselves, in our own little world, that all that's left in its wake is confusion and evil. By the churches. So what happens is we can become like the Midianites back in chapter 7, remember? They were killing each other in the dark rather than practicing the onslaught against the enemy. Why? How did that happen? Confusion. Arrogance and confusion. And confusion beat him. Gary Enrig wrote an excellent Judges commentary, by the way. He wrote in his commentary, he said this, "This is not a tactic from the past. Satan uses it time and time again. When people are trusting Christ, when young Christians are being discipled, when established believers are growing and maturing, Satan will bend every effort to sow disunity. He does not care why we are divided. He just cares that we are." Now, luckily, we've been blessed through the years that we haven't had some of the stupid battles that I saw as a kid growing up in the denominational church, where we have church splits because we couldn't decide what color carpet to put in the basement. And I'm not kidding you, by the way. How ridiculous, right? But certainly I see it out there. See, if the people of Ephraim were so wrong here, why did Gideon deal with them the way that he did? I mean, certainly that begs the question. I mean, if their attitude was wrong, why did he soft pedal? I mean, you think Gideon was afraid here? Do you think he was intimidated? You think he was ashamed that he didn't make the call? Now, I don't know for sure. Again, this is my opinion, so this is not a biblical premise. I'm just throwing it out there. I would challenge you that Gideon didn't have the time to take his eyes off the enemy. That Gideon wasn't going to get distracted on such a trite skirmish as all of this. He's like, yeah, yeah, boys, whatever. Why? Because Gideon had business to take care of and he wasn't going to get distracted. I mean, he was here in this situation, he was in the throes of battle and he wasn't going to let Satan or Ephraim or anybody else distract him from what he was called to do. Now, why would I come up with that? Why would I just conjecture that? 20 years of ministry. I'm just speaking from 20 years of ministry. Having been in that scenario, having been in that situation time and time again, it's like I can stop to go put out this brush fire, or I can just, you know, push this brush fire aside and focus on, you know, the forest fire over here. The forest fire being Satan. Lost souls. See, because I'm just old enough and you know, to think that when I read the newspaper today that I just tend to think, man, she looks like she's wrapping up. You know, and then I got an assistant pastor who's showing me on YouTube giant sinkholes in Siberia that are appearing out of nowhere, that, and then just to freak me out. So, you know, to me it looks like the whole world's collapsing out there, you know. And so I'm just old enough to go, you know what, she looks like she's all wrapping up. So am I going to get distracted over here on this little thing? Now, and if you attend here, you know that I'm about as apolitical as they come. But Christians, is this really a time to get tangled up in political issues in a world that is not my home? Are you going to legislate morality? Are you going to make them stop by outlawing? Are you really? When Jesus said the only thing that changes a man is Jesus. And the only thing that changes the heart is salvation. I got an idea. Let's put our money and our efforts and our time into changing people's lives and bringing them to redemption. All those other issues will be taken care of. Now, you take it for what it's worth, but that's where I stand on this. I'm not willing to spend my time stomping brush fires. We got a war to fight. Gideon here realized that he wasn't going to let Satan distract him. And I think Gideon probably, if he had a lick of sense about him, I think he probably realized that he wasn't going to talk these guys out of pride. Have you ever talked anybody out of pride? Because I've never successfully done that. Can't say that I haven't tried a few times. I have never, in all the years of ministry, can I recall one time where I ever talked anybody out of pride. I've never found that to work. The only thing that breaks us of pride that I have found to be successful, and Proverbs 16:18 will attest to this, is the only thing that breaks us of pride is the fall that comes after it. Pain. Knock the feet out from underneath you, break you down. That usually takes the pride. I know it in my own life. But Gideon here, he was focused. He didn't have time for distractions. It wasn't that he didn't care about his people. He wasn't trying to just diss them or throw them under the bus. He seemed to readily know what his calling was and that he was not going to get distracted. Now, that's a lesson for me. I take that personally. It's like, okay, I see. I get you there, Gideon. I got it. But these folks, tribe of Ephraim, like so many people that have followed, they had a lot of time to discuss their feelings because they didn't have any burden. They didn't have any passion for God's calling. They weren't fighting. There's something about intensely serving the Lord that knocks that out of you. I mean, the people that are the hardest to handle for me as a pastor are the people who they're not serving. They just got a lot of time on their hands. They're full of great ideas and complaints and guidance of ministry and all that kind of stuff. You know, and they always talk about how they feel and all the rest, because you know what? When you're on the battle line, the front line with people, and the swords are drawn, the enemy's coming at you and you're going to fight, you're not really caught up with that trite stuff. You're just like, we're all together. We're all going to fight. And these guys beside me, I need to take care of them because they're going to take care of me. It changes your whole perspective. But Ephraim didn't have a sense of God's purpose. A lot of people have no sense of God's purpose. And again, invariably, these are the people who spend so much time in criticism of other believers, of the church they attend, of the pastor that leads there, because they don't have any urgency and they don't have any passion for serving God. So they have plenty of time to stand on the sidelines and critique. Now, Gideon handled the situation. And once he was out of that jam, once the children there in Ephraim were appeased with another ice cream, he was back on the front lines immediately, wasn't he? Say, you guys, okay, because I got something I got to do. Boom, he was on it. He was back out there chasing those guys again, back on the front lines. out in pursuit of the fleeing enemy. And doing this now, he comes across. Now, remember, they crossed over the River Jordan into the Promised Land. So all this is playing out in the Promised Land. Now he's crossing back over the River Jordan to chase the Midianites. Having done that, he comes into a city of Israel on the other side of the River Jordan called Succoth. The response he received, in my opinion, was up a pro, because if you know about these guys, you would think that this would be exactly what you'd expect to get from them. These folks who lived in this town, they were the people who, way back at the beginning, back when Israel was coming out of Egypt, they had the whole wilderness, parting the Red Sea, you know, the manna, the quail that we've gone over recently, all that business. Then they're going to cross over to the River Jordan. These people, ultimately, even though they went over to help for a while, ultimately they said, you know what? We want to live on this side of the river. Now, I don't have time tonight, but if you know anything about the spiritual ramifications of the meaning of the River Jordan, you would know that that is not a good idea. But they stayed on the other side of the River Jordan, and now they are in this situation. They were living here, and Gideon has come to them. These are the people that want to live as close as they can to God's chosen, as they want to saddle up to God's people. They want to saddle up to what the place where God's doing great work, and they just want to kind of suck off of the life off of that situation, like through osmosis. See, they didn't want to be over on the River Jordan. They didn't want to be fighting in the Promised Land all the time. They didn't want to have to deal with all that stuff over there. They wanted to live on the other side of the River Jordan. It was quieter over there, and they didn't have to fight the enemies over there. But they wanted to live close because, you know, they understood that God was doing a cool thing over there, and that was God's Promised Land, and that was God's chosen people. And so we don't want to live over there where all the fighting goes on, but can we stand close? We don't want to get involved in the service of the church, but can we hang around the church? Well, we don't want to really tithe our time or tithe our finances or really be a part of the fellowship here, but can I come to church on Sunday and just kind of, you know, nuzzle up close because it looks like God's really moving here and I might kind of catch some of that good God vibe? That was these people. Thus, the people of God were divided. Now, I'm not trying to be mean, but you need to understand that churches are full of these tribes. There's always going to be that. It's always been that way. I'm not poking you. And by the way, if you're like, oh, you know, he's talking about me tonight. No, I'm not. I don't, you know, forget it. I don't even know most of the time. So, you know, it's I'm not after anybody. I'm speaking here because this is a reality in every church throughout the world. Am I sanctioning it? Oh, by no means, no. These tribes in the future would be the first to fall to the enemy. Which tribes? The tribes who aren't really in the game. They're not in the Promised Land. They're just close to the Promised Land. They're not where the battle's going on. They're just close to the battle. They're not in the fight. They're just close to the fight. They're not participating. They just want to hang around the people who are participating because it's a good vibe. And you know what, JFB? That's always been a good vibe here. So oftentimes people come like, man, hey, seems like things are happening in this church, man. I like these people. This is cool. But it only works when you're part of the game, when you're in. Oh, no, that battle's in there. Yep. Ooh, that seems hard. Yep. Seems kind of time consuming. Yep. Wow, seems like those people, they're like all in. Uh-huh. But you can't catch God through osmosis. So certainly we all should be asking, are we a spectator? Am I an armchair Christian? Or am I actually on the field? The these tribes would be the first to fall to the enemies in the future. The enemies come up, and these tribes on the other side of the river, they went down in flames because they weren't all in. They weren't committed. Now, once inside of Succoth, Gideon here, he sought assistance in the form of food. Seems like a simple thing. What he got instead was ridicule, and he got jest and more overt pride. It's like, really, Gideon? I mean, you want us to give you food? Where are these kings you're pursuing, you know? You say you got it going on, man. Where are they? You're just all talk, Gideon. We aren't giving you any food. And again, if you've walked with God and you wanted to be a servant of Him and you have served Him over the years, you know what it's like. It's a painful thing when those who should be your greatest supporters fail to come through. Family. Maybe even family who say they're Christians. Friends. Maybe some of them who say they're Christians. When they don't believe in you, they don't believe in what you're doing, they don't believe in your mission, they don't believe in your God, they only believe in themselves and their own pursuits. And they think the zeal and the passion that you have for Christ, it's just all wrong. These are people living on the other side. Close, but not close enough. And I tell you, these are times, if you've been here, you can relate to this. There are times like these that can actually be some of the most discouraging moments in your life. At least speaking firsthand here, speaking personally. They can be some of the most painful moments. Gideon here seemed to be undeterred, though. I'm amazed by that. I mean, what kept this guy going? And again, I can only conjecture. I'll ask him when I get there. But from where I'm sitting, it seems that it's because Gideon kept the facts in front of him and not his emotions. I mean, no matter what they said, the reality was that the enemy, no matter how big they were on the run. And he probably had to stop and go, oh, yeah, you're right, man. That's true. I don't have these guys. Wait a minute. These guys are running from us, aren't they? Wait. Focus, Gideon. Focus. We got them on the run. This is not a time to quit. And furthermore, Gideon knew that God was on his side. He knew it. Why? Because God had already proved it. God had already manifested himself. God had always like, Gideon, I got your back, man. Thus, with these folks, Succoth, there would be no unity. And I want you to notice that in this situation, Gideon didn't pretend that there was. There was no false facade here. There was no pretending. People of Succoth here and over here, and Gideon and his boys on their side, two different sides here. Two different passions. Two different directions in life. And he didn't hang around and try to convince the people of Succoth that what he was doing was righteous. You ever have that conversation with the family and the friend that you tried to convince them? Doesn't work so well, does it? Jesus himself instructed that they shake the dust from their feet and move on. That's what they did. Listen, I think it's important for us all to realize this morning that no one wants disunity. Okay? I mean, I think we should always try to avoid that. We should always seek for unity. Nobody wants division. Fleshly division is sin. But so is fleshly unity. And pretending, because you know what pretending is? It's lying. There are times that we must say to people who claim the name of Jesus, but deny the power thereof, Okay? 2 Timothy 3:5. That we must say to those people that we can't be a part of them. And that we are called to turn away from them. That's the Bible. That's not this church's doctrine. But it is a forgotten passage. That there are times we must separate. We don't like that. It's so politically incorrect, isn't it? I mean, it's just under every term, it just kind of makes the hair on our back of our neck stand up. Oh, dude, that, oh, I don't, oh. I mean, I don't know. It sounds so shunning, you know. I feel like I'm Amish or something here, you know. And I don't know, you know. I'm not saying you don't talk to them. I'm not saying you don't say hi to them at Fleet Farm. I'm talking about fellowship and unity. And everyone in this room knows the difference. There would be eventually a great judgment on these people. Not that day. Again, got a job to do. I'll get back to you. I got to go after these boys. I'll see you later. Gideon, again, wasn't going to be deterred by the ungodliness of others, nor the passivity of their character, or them dissing him, or, you know, discouraging him, or whatever. He wasn't going to be deterred. See, it's important to realize, Christian, that when we stand before the Master, the weakest excuse we could possibly give him is, you know, so-and-so didn't want me to do that. Yeah, you know, I really got a lot of pressure. You know, my parents told me I was just too involved with Jesus. Yeah, that'll go over. Could you imagine telling the Master that? Yeah, you know, people really got up in my face and said, you know, I was just too involved. And, you know, it was just kind of over the top and kind of cultish. You know, I shouldn't have been. Really? You're going to tell the Master that? The Master who didn't exactly dabble in our salvation, did he? He actually was beaten beyond recognition and nailed to a wooden cross with spikes. Sounds like he was all in to me. And you know what, Christian? He wants us all in also. Aren't we lucky that Jesus wasn't kind of dabbling on the weekends with us? Well, it's time for crucifixion. You know, I would, but I'm just not really too sure where Jesus is. I think he's, you know, he's away. This is his soccer weekend. I think he's not really able to be here. No, Jesus had one focus, one task. To redeem mankind. That's all that was on the table. Gideon was all in. Jesus was all in. Everything was on the line. He held nothing back. This evening, gang, the whole world is full of people who will never know commitment and they will never experience consistency in their life. The wind blows and they're over here, and the wind blows and they're over there. Their lives are tumultuous and precarious. And when I look at them, they are miserable and they cause everyone around them misery. What a lesson this evening for us. D.L. Moody once said, "Give me a man who says, this one thing I do, not these 50 things I dabble with." Benjamin Disraeli said, quote, "The secret to success is consistency of purpose," end quote. Gideon knew that. I wonder this evening, do we know that? Do we understand that? We're so easily distracted, aren't we? Shiny objects, right? Ooh, and off we go, like a little kid. How easily we get interrupted. We fail to understand that to greatly serve Jesus everything must be surrendered. To greatly serve Jesus, everything must be surrendered. Everything must be run through that one sieve called Jesus Christ. No one does great things for Jesus as a hobby on the weekends. Doing great things for Jesus will cost you deeply. And for that, we experience him greatly. Are you with me? I've shared this before. I always tell the people in the ministerial community, as they step into that world, I tell them, the middle of your life is going to fade away. The further you go, the less middle there will be. So when people ask you, how's it going? Oh, it's the best of times and the worst of times. The hell gets worse and the glory gets brighter. The battles get more intense, but the view of Jesus and what he does in your midst gets greater and greater. So you almost got to just be kind of sadistic. You got to be willing to take that hit because you want to see the mountaintop that much. And it doesn't just work for the people in the ministerial community. It works for people who are in any kind of ministry who are serving God. That's the way it goes down. Not all the apostles were up there on the Mount of Transfiguration, were they? There was just a few boys there that day. But what a sight. And ultimately, what a cost. I wonder if we could ask him today, was it worth it? Was it worth it? I mean, for those who say yes, they experience God in this kind of manner. For those who say no, well, they don't. I mean, if you could run into these guys today. Paul, was it worth it? Would you do it all again? John the Baptist, beheaded. Would you do it again, John? Would you do it all over again? Even guys like Dale Moody and Billy Graham and all the great missionaries, many of them dying in the field. Would you do it again? Sounds like the price was heavy. Would you do it again? And ultimately there, that's the question that will be answered in heaven. Would you do it again? Because I've thought about it. I ain't even dead yet. I've thought about it. I mean, I'm at about the 20-year mark. I mean, I can't believe I've been in this town that long. You know, at my age, you think about that. You go, you know, would you like to do something else? Would you have done something else? And you know, and you think about all that, and for the life of me, I always come back to the same answer. Would you do it all again? In a heartbeat. Because where I'm sitting, it's been the ride of my life. Some of you, very few of you, but there's a few of you that go back to when there was only a dozen people sitting in white plastic chairs. Do you ever think we'd be here? Would you do it all again? Yes, I would. Now, don't get me wrong. It causes me pause. There's been hell to pay. There's been blood. There's been bruises. There's been tears. It hasn't come easy. Would you do it all again? Yes, I would. Let me tell you something. Isn't that the greatest answer of your life when you get to the end? Wouldn't you want to say, would you do it all again? Yes, I would, just like that. That's finishing well. That's finishing well. Gideon experienced a complete victory because he was completely invested. Therefore, a partial commitment gives you what? Exactly. God seeks for you to be all in. I know that's not a politically correct move today. There'd be people who say, you're crazy. Probably quite a few of them. But the goal at the end is to get to the end and go, I do it all again. I have been blessed to see God do great things. I've been there for the parting of the Red Sea, and I've been there at the Mount of Transfiguration, spiritually speaking. I wouldn't have missed him for nothing. I put some of you together in marriage. I've been there as you went on and had children. I dedicated your children and baptized your children, and a couple of crazy cases, I married your children. But they got married at 12, so it doesn't really count. So, do it all again. There is no halfway in Christianity, guys. And we will never be a church, God willing, that will ever stand for that. Let's all stand.